for just about everything for the outdoors. Go to MidwayUSA.com.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit Tecovas.com. That's Tecovas.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to Tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hello there, everyone. As you're listening now, myself and the Elk Bros crew are actually in the mountains chasing elk. But we wanted those folks still on deck with hunts yet to come to have some content that might help you this season or for seasons to come. So on today's special edition of Blue Collar Elk Hunting, it's a show that I recorded with John Stallone, and I was his guest on his Days in the Wild podcast. And even though the topic is about what to do 30 days out, there are a ton of nuggets, y'all, and information that I really feel could be used by so many folks up to the day before they leave and even during the hunt. So with that said, pull up a chair, adjust your volumes just right, and welcome to Blue Collar Elk Hunting. And guys, welcome to Elk Camp.
Welcome to Blue Collar Elk Hunting, brought to you by ElkBros.com, with your host Gilbert Ornelas and elk hunting coach Joe Gilley. You want to hunt elk, and they live to hunt elk. Their goal is to share with you what they have learned grinding it out for over 35 seasons doing what they love. So come on into camp and set a spell. Welcome to Blue Collar Elk Hunters.
Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today we are going to talk with my good friend, Joe Ilya from Blue Collar Elk podcast and the Elk Bros. And I, you know what? I always wondered why you didn't keep the podcast name and the website the same. Cause every time I go to search your podcast, I put it in the Elk Bros and I'm like, wait a second. It's not called the Elk Bros. I got to do it the other way.
Well, we actually have tagged Elk Bros on the front of it now. So it is the Elk Bros Blue Collar podcast now. And so hopefully when you do a search, you find it like that. But I don't know, dude, it was like, and I had a lot of people when we started out, they were, you know, especially people in marketing, like, well, it's not a good idea to have two different names. I'm like, well, what we were about was the message. First of all, we wanted people to understand what our show was about.
Right.
Yeah, and, yeah, so, I mean, to me, that was more important for people to understand who we were, what we were about, and the Elk Bros part would come along, and, it, you know, it kind of did, and so, in fact, we have a lot of people, like, they search for Elk Bros as two different words, and I kind of market it as one word, but, it all works out, and I think now things are starting to come together, and people are starting to recognize who we are and attach us to the podcast. But, you know, I mean, we've got a lot of things going because we have that. We have Elk Bros Adventures going on. We got the, you know, the Blue Collar Elk Academy, you know, with Base Camp. So there's all of these little components. And I don't know, maybe it's kind of good they're a little separate in some ways, but yeah, I'm not a marketing guru. I'm just a guy who loves to hunt.
Same here. I had a similar issue because I when I brought my podcast to the masses in 2015, it was interviews with the Hunting Masters, and that was a carryover from what I was doing when I was doing the podcast for just the Hunting Channel. And I did that because I was going to reuse a lot of my old content too, you know, just to start out to kind of feel it. And then, you know, I went along for, I don't know how many years doing that. And man, I'm like, man, first off, I was like, the name's really pretentious sounding, you know, like people don't understand that I'm interviewing people that I think I believe to be the master of whatever it is I'm talking to them about. So it got misconstrued a little bit. And I, you know, so then I tried, I was like, all right, well, I'm going to change the name to Days in the Wild, like my TV show, like my pod, like my blog, and, you know, keep it all in my outfitting service, like keep it all the same. And I did that. It was a good change. I think I did lose a few people in the beginning, like, cause they got confused, but I think they eventually figured it out.
And what I'm like, and really for me, it's like I'm not looking for people that are looking for blue collar or elk hunting. You know, I'm looking for people that do a search for elk hunting, and you know, hopefully they find us that way. You know,
right. Anyway, so it's we're about a month out. We're about a month out from D-Day. So
panic mode.
Yeah. And I kind of wanted to go over and kind of give the listeners, I don't know, like a roadmap as to what they should be doing a month out. You know, what are some of the things? I know some of the things that I'm doing. I'll share those as well, but like to kind of hear from you and what it is that you are doing at this point in the game.
Yeah. So what's really cool about that, John, is so like we're elk hunting coaches, and right now, like I'm in coaching mode with, my athletes, the competitors from Hunt Wars, you know, getting them ready basically 30 days out. And we also have our own, coached hunt that we're doing, because that's, you know, in our Elk Bros Adventures, we actually have hunts where we're coaching guys. So we are doing, we're doing coaching through Zoom sessions right now with my coaching staff with all these guys. So we get a real good look at where people are and where they're not 30 days out and what they're still working on, what the holes are in their game, you know, those types of things. So, that really has given a pretty good roadmap. And I find that it's interesting that a lot of people have spent a lot of time on logistics, right? They're like, their plans to get out there, where they're going to hunt, getting their tags, having all of that stuff in place to get there. But it seems like the skill sets that once they do get there, you know, it's real hit or miss on a lot of people. And I think that's what we're finding, through coaching people 30 days out, you know, where they're, the areas that they need to kind of up their game so that they're eliminating. And that's what we're all about as coaches. We're really trying to help people eliminate failure points. Prior to getting there so that, you know, I mean, we both know, right? Every time that you have an encounter, first of all, you got to create an encounter, right?
Right.
Then once you do find yourself in an encounter, it's like, how many stories do we hear from people that, well, you know, this happened, my site moved or it got bumped or, you know, I went to go draw back and I caught my release on my face mask, or, you know, my read went out at the wrong time, or my peak sight turned. I mean, there's just like all of these tons of, you know, all these little failure points that things could have ended up being a success story, but it's kind of like the same old fish thing. You know, it was this far away from the shore, you know, when it got off, you know, so, I think that's where we're at. And what I really, you know, have started with, and as I'm coaching people, I kind of go through a few different things. You know, we talk about their game plan. We talk about where they should be physically and what they should be doing at this time. You know, we talk about the different ways of filling up their toolbox. And it's just like when I'm working with my teams, like when I was preparing for a championship season, at this point in the game, basically you should be taking the time to look at the little details to prevent some of those failure points, right? And then I think a big thing right now is to do those things that are going to actually eliminate lost time in their thought process in an encounter, so that some of those things, so they're not doing discovery and learning from the failures at the time for the next time. So, right, you know, hopefully they're not going through five encounters before they realize that they should be setting up in front of stuff instead of behind stuff. You know what I mean? So I think that's where I'm at right now. And I can kind of share some of those things that we've been talking about along the way. And calling, dude, calling has been huge too. It's amazing how many people are going to actually try to have their calling down probably on the drive out.
Yeah. This year, myself included, I haven't practiced at all. And I listen, this is something I've been doing for years and years and years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah,
I still, if I don't practice year round, I don't feel confident going into that season.
But at least, dude, you've got like how many years of base, right?
Yeah, I mean, true. But it's still, I'm trying to bring that up. I'm like, so if you're new at this and you're waiting to do it, like, it's a very perishable talent, you know?
Well, and then what happens to the funny thing about that is that a lot of guys will, and gals, when I say guys, I'm a coach. So I like to throw everybody in together in one pile.
Me too.
So a lot of people are going to be on that drive and they're going to be blowing the crap out of their reeds. They're going to get to the hunt, and on day one, they're going to go and it's like, what the heck? Because they've worked it so hard, blowing on it all that time, and that previous little bit of previous time, that they're actually going to probably blow out some of those things. And then when it comes time to hunt, they're not going to have the call that they want, really. You know what I mean?
So that being said, I want to interject something here. One of the things that I've done is I always buy. So I'm a three reed guy anyway, but I usually keep three reeds three of each of those three types that I'm going to use.
Yep.
And I'll make sure I don't leave that one in the package. You know, I'll take it out and I will make sure I'll test it and make sure, because sometimes they just don't have the same sound out of the box. Some of them need a little stretch. Some of them need a little, you know, breaking in, whatever. But
absolutely,
I'll have one that I practice with, and I might even start the hunt off with it based on how, you know, like what you were saying, how worn out it gets.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll progress to the other ones as the hunts go on, you know. But that's a good, that's a really easy failure point right there to avoid.
Absolutely. I mean, that shows your expertise, though, right there. I mean, that was one of the things, like when I talk about time for little details, that on that trip out, they should absolutely be breaking in their second and third set of reeds. I mean, that's what they should be doing, is going through those. And like you said, testing, because, you know, I mean, you could actually buy five reeds and there's always a chance in production that you end up with one that just isn't going to do anything that you want it to do. You know what I mean? So that might be a toss, and you don't want to find that out when you're out there. Like, you took one good one and you have a backup. Anytime that I'm out there, basically I've got probably about five reeds that I'm rolling through, because I'm going to have two that I want just for if I'm really in tight and I'm just needing low sweet cow calls. I have something that I know is going to give me a low sweet cow call. And then, mm-hmm. you know, I have three of my favorite one that I like that's either my all around, or I'm going to have one that's just like the screamer that I can, you know, it's got that thicker latex that I can just scream all day on it if that's what, you know, I need to do. But what I like to do is actually rotate and roll through my calls. So I actually always have a backup to the one that I'm using on that day, mm-hmm. just so that when it starts to get wet and warm, and I just rotate it out and I put it in my, you know, I have a vented call holder that's going to let it dry out.
Yep, same.
So that, yeah, so you're not blowing it out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I don't think people, you know, like I talk to people and I work with guys, like, you know, right now we're doing calling things. I said, let me hear your cow call. And I hear a sound like, oh, my God, man, how old is that call? Well, I used it all last season. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's
first
a problem
off, that's
A
gross.
Right there.
You're putting that back in your mouth. That's disgusting. But, you know, yeah, I end of the season, they all go in the garbage, or I might convert them to, coyote calls. Like I might use them for predator calling for a little bit, you know,
yeah,
after
yeah.
that, but that's about it.
Yeah. But you know, and I've been there, I've done that, you know, I mean, it used to be, I mean, there were some of the older Primos that I used to get, like a Primos white or black, and mm-hmm. man, those things would last forever.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, and then you kind of look at it and you can see a little bit of wah wah in the latex, you know, where it's
yep.
starting to just give out. But I think that's a huge thing, with that. And, you know, when I talk about, you know, those little details, you know, we shoot, I guess we have this huge preparation time, and then we're like, okay, we're ready, and then we jump in and we get over there. And after all this preparation, after all this wear and tear on our bows and our shooting equipment, we forget to actually do a little, you know, a little check over maintenance point. Just checking for things like, you know, adding some bow wax to screws that could come loose to make sure that they don't, you know, adding a little bow wax to our threads on our broadheads that we put in just to give them. I mean, if you don't want to use Loctite, I mean,
right,
some
right,
people
yeah.
do that. Yeah, I'm not a Loctite person.
Nor am I.
But I think bow wax is just great on threads, and it really helps you get through because, you know, if you're around on UTVs, ATVs, mm-hmm. Shoot, I mean, things get rattled, they get loose, and that's how sight pins and stuff end up moving and sights end up moving. You know, even like the screws inside your release on some of those could actually come out. And this is the first time for me that I'm actually having to deal with all of that kind of stuff, you know, all of these extra components. I've always just had a glove on, I pulled back, look, and shot. But I tell you, man, when you're shooting with releases and you've got pins and you've got sights and you have kisser buttons and mm-hmm. peep sights, I mean, you add a lot of little complexities that you had better make sure are ready when you're going to be out there, because I don't know if it's 5 days, 7 days, 10, 14 days, but that's it, you
yep.
know? And you drive 24 hours to get there and something goes off on it when you're in the middle of nowhere, you know, if you don't have a backup bow. And I'm telling you, I don't know how many people really, John, afford having a backup bow, right?
Exactly. It's not cheap. I mean,
no.
A full setup nowadays, you know, easily $1,600, yep. you know, $1,700, maybe.
Easy.
You know, easy. You know,
easy.
That's on the lower end.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, you had better prepare for the small redundancies or prevention to make sure that, you know, that hunt isn't going to be a huge lesson, you know, before the next year, right?
Right.
So,
real quick before we jump off of this part of this, what uh-huh. we're talking about, one of the things that I know that I've done, and this came out of traveling, mm-hmm. Is I go through and I mark everything with a little silver Sharpie marker. That's bow timing, cams, everything on the site. So windage and elevation, even if you have second axis, third axis, those marks. I mark everything, even where my peep is and my kisser button, because it's just a quick glance. I can look, oh, okay, shit, this moved. How did this move? Right. You know, and it's much easier to get things back to good if you have that.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely, man. That's a great tip right there. Sure is. You know, so, and the other one is like not only checking your equipment, but also using your equipment. Like, you know, have they used or shot in or practiced with everything that they're going to wear while they're hunting?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I mean, everything. Don't have any exception. If you're going to wear a neck gaiter and you're going to have it pulled up over your nose, you had better be shooting with that neck gaiter on. I don't care what you look like or if your, you know, neighbors look at you kind of funny, but I tell you, when you go to pull back and you put a kisser button in the corner of your mouth or a Bomar on your tip of your nose or anything like that,
it
feels different when you got something on your face.
100%. 100%.
Yeah, and I mean, do you wear something on the front? Are you going to wear bino case on the front? Myself, I hate when I'm elk hunting to wear anything that is going to keep me from quickly taking off a lair. That's just me. I'm not much for being strapped into anything because it's, you know, if I'm in hot pursuit and generally what's happening is, you know, you've got a destination herd that you're actually trying to parallel and get up to where they're going on the parallel side of them. So you can't waste a lot of time at certain times. And then all of a sudden you start to break into a sweat as you're moving up. I like to really just, I mean, I'm down, I pull it off, cram it on the pack back on and I'm going again. Whereas if I have something strapped on my chest, I'm having to unsnap that, take it off. And then I'm always worried about, and there's the other thing, little tip for everybody is you got to always go through a post check, what I call a post check pat, you know, so, if you have a grunt tube that you wear on you, if you do have that bino case on you, if you do have a release that is actually a release that isn't attached to you, if you have binos that you put in one side of your pocket or anything, you know, always as soon as you stand up, you go through that post stand up pat, man, and look around you. Otherwise, you know, there's going to be somebody coming across some equipment in the woods that you're going to wish you had, right?
Yep. Absolutely.
How many times has that happened to you, John?
More than I care to. And you want to laugh? The funniest thing is the one thing that was designed for you not to get lost, I've lost more times than it was my GPS. I've left like $600 Garmin Rhinos out in the freaking woods. Like, I don't know how many times, three times I think I lost them. Yeah.
Oh,
just
no.
Stupid, stupid stuff. Yeah.
and it's one of these things too, is where, you know, like if you have to stop and you're pulling everything off and you end up pulling off your gloves just so that you can grab everything or something like that, I swear, man, you'll just stand up and you'll take off without them.
Oh yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's
happened so more times than I care to.
Yeah. But you need to shoot in. You need to practice with all that stuff because a weighted pack. I mean, you're going to be out there for days with a pack that you don't shoot with in your backyard. And what is going to happen with that? Is it going to make a swoosh sound? You know, is it going to affect you in one way or another? Is there anything that is hanging off that could get in your string? You know, you need to shoot all that stuff and find those failure points before you get out there. I'm just not one to have anything loose on the front of me. I don't want anything to get in the way if possible, right?
Yeah, so, I could see that for sure. I do wear a bino pack, but I've gotten used to it and I've gotten used to, you know, shooting with that and just knowing that it's there and it's got to go back there. But to take your point further, I actually got a video of this up on my, I think it's on my YouTube. I like to put myself, once I get to my destination, I like to put myself in a very realistic situation and throw a target up out there. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking the example that I did was, that's on the YouTube, is I was mule deer hunting in Utah. I was at above 10,000 feet and everything was steep angled. So I put a target way down below me, mm-hmm. and I practiced shooting before I went out hunting. And just to get a feel for, one, make sure you're dealing with different elevations. You might have sighted your bow in at 1,100 feet, and now you're at 11,000 feet, you know.
Whatever. It makes a difference. But.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. You know, just kind of going through those motions, definitely one, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit later on here, is confidence. It's going to build confidence for you. Because that's
absolutely.
When I'm a month out, that's everything. Everything about it, what I do is confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's confidence.
When you look at all of these things that we're talking about, you know, when you know how solid you are by looking at all of these different aspects, mm-hmm. that gives you that innate confidence. That gives you, when you put your hand on the bow and you start to walk in the woods, it's not with doubt in your mind. It's just like, man, that, I mean, as soon as you, I don't know if it happens to you, man, when I grab that freaking grip on my bow, it's almost like there's a transformation and a confidence that I'm going out there, that something's going down, right? You have that feeling, and you're exactly right. Success in elk hunting is about confidence. Confidence comes from preparation. Confidence comes from knowing and preparing for things ahead of time that you're going to see or is going to happen.
Right.
I mean, that's why another tip I would give people is, for example, do the things that are going to eliminate lost time in your thought processing during an encounter. Like a lot of these guys, if you think about this, if you hunt a 5-day hunt for elk and you've done it for 5 years, that means that you've actually had a month's worth of elk hunting experience.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah. We've had this conversation many times on my podcast. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So for those people that, like, I guide professionally. So, I mean, I'm guiding from September all the way through to January. So I have all of these encounters, all these experience with elk that a lot of people just don't have. And so I've seen all of so many different shots and shot angles. And I'm going to jump back to what you were saying, because one of the things that we do is, as soon as we get hunters that up to where I guide at, and it's, you know, 8, 9, 10,000 feet, first thing that we do is have them shoot a target, and most people are low to the left. I don't know why, but most people are. It's weird. So it's real critical to do that. But when we talk about this, your encounters, there's so many times and there's so many things that people will see an elk in a position at a distance, and their mind is rolling on, is that a good shot? Where should I place it? What is happening here? And by the time they actually start to make a decision in that process, that window of opportunity is gone,
mm-hmm.
right? So what I tell people is, look, if you don't live in elk areas, you don't have all that experience, there's still, man, look at different pictures, photos, videos of elk, and work on recognizing body positions and determining whether or not it's going to be a marginal or if it's going to be a shot, effective killing shot for you. You need to do that way ahead of time. And I mean, not just looking at a broadside animal and saying, okay, there's my shot spot. That's where I'm doing, because you're going to have elk that are in a quarter two. They're going to be quarter. In fact, very seldom do you have an absolutely broadside animal. Almost never.
I think I've only shot one elk that was broadside.
Right?
Yeah.
Really?
Most of the time they're quartering too.
Yeah, either a quartering two.
Because they're coming into
away.
A call, you know. They're mm-hmm. walking towards you, you know.
Absolutely.
And you don't always have the ability to. And me, I'm a cheat the wind kind of guy. So mm-hmm. you don't always get that, like, circle that they come to, you know, possibly give you a more broadside shot. I don't know.
That's, right.
But yeah, no, I hear you.
Well,
exactly.
And they're either coming down a hill, going up a hill, walking straight across, or you're up above them, or they're up above you, you know, all of those different angles. And even though you as a hunter has not seen all of these things, that doesn't mean you're not able to see it now. And to see those images and recognize the body positions, like, pay attention that if it's quartering away, that you're not going to be shooting at the onside leg, that you're shooting on the offside leg. Mm-hmm. Or if it's quartering to you, you're going to see part of the front legs both, you know, looking as it's stepping that way towards you. You should be able to recognize that. So learn to recognize those body positions and then determine, and in your mind, tell yourself, at that position, that's not my shot. Or what am I going to wait for? At this position, that is my shot. This is where it's going to go. So, I tell everybody, okay, if it comes to a frontal shot, I don't coach it. Mm. And the reason I don't coach it is because I don't know their ability level. I don't know how calm they are under pressure. I don't know all of these other variables that would determine. I mean, they could shoot dimes at 20, 30, or 40 all day long in their backyard, but mm-hmm. you go out there and you add all these other elements to it, and then you add an animal that could all of a sudden move or turn or anything like that. It changes things. So that's something that each of our listeners have to determine. That's their own judgment as to what is their marginal.
Right.
I don't teach people to take frontals. You know, I would, you know, I frontal or even like a quartering two, again, for the same reason, right?
Right.
I try to tell people, even on a broadside shot, a lot of people, you know, when you shoot a lot of 3D, all of the 10 ring and the 12 ring is right there in that golden triangle area. And yet for me, I always have people up the back leg, mid body, 3 inches back, you know, from away from the hip, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is the spot that on a broadside animal that I tell people to shoot for. I want two holes. I want it going through so fast. I want those lungs deflated, and I want that animal down in 10 to 15 seconds. Now, are you always going to get that shot? No. So what happens now if he's quartering away a little bit? Well, now that falls to the offside leg. And just learn to recognize that. And already have in your mind go through picture after picture. I don't care if it's 200 pictures. Look on video. Stop the video. And then determine, do I have my shot? Is that my shot? If it's a no, you should recognize that right away. That means you're waiting. If you're waiting, what are you waiting for? And then play that video. See what that animal does. Because most likely, unless it's going across in front of you, at first where it's quartering and turns, you might get that shot. Or as it starts to go, you know, from where it's far away and coming closer, you might get the shot that you want. If you are, if you know the anatomy and you've been doing this for a while and you can, you know, put it in that front shoulder on the front side of it or a frontal, both devastating. The golden triangle, devastating. But, you know, I really want to ensure a clean, ethical, quick kip, right? So that's the way I coach. But you got to prepare your mind ahead of time so that when you are in that situation, it's a go, no go. And I mean right now, mm-hmm. go, no go. Okay.
Yeah. So you're not flustered into making a bad shot.
Absolutely. You know, and I mean, that happens. You've been hunting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I still do.
5 days of a 6 day hunt, you know, and all of a sudden the animal presents itself and it's like, it's the only animal I've seen. It's the only one that's been in close.
You force it.
But and you force it. And you got to ask yourself, you know, what is your goal? Your goal is not to put an arrow in an animal. Your goal is to put that animal down mm-hmm. quick and fast, right? So, you know, maybe it's that story, but you know, if that animal is in that position, you know, what actions will you be taking? If it's not right, if he's in your window, what are you going to do? So a lot of people, and we coach, if an animal steps in your window and you're a full draw, stop him, you know, stop him with a grunt, you know, do something that you can stop that animal.
Right.
Google at him, you know, if he is in search of, a cow and everything's quiet and he's looking for it, then yeah, you can just give a little sweet cow call and stop him. But have you practiced that, man? Have you drawn back and then had to give a grunt and shoot? Are you somebody that's going to change form when you do that because you've never done it? Can you bugle at the same time and then shoot a target while you're doing it? You know? So I guess what I'm trying to do is tell people, like you were saying, John, is to get in those actual hunting situations. Practice those setups. Yeah. Recognize setups.
You want it to be as automatic as possible. Like, absolutely. You want to be able to recognize what's being presented to you right then and there in that moment, and be, I don't even want to use the word reactive. Reactive is even too slow. Like, you want to just know, like, this is what needs to get done right now.
Go, no go, man. Yeah. I mean, I'm there. It's a go. Boom. It's off. Right.
Yep.
Or it's a no go, and then know what I'm looking for after that. You know, if the animal's walking, at what distance? I mean, you can shoot an animal walking at 10 yards, an elk, if he's just moving just like that. I mean, it's just so close. It's just boom. Mm-hmm. But I mean, at 20 yards, you're going to want to stop that animal. 30 yards, absolutely, man. So, you know, you've got to just know, what are my actions I'm going to do in this situation? And, you know, you can do that by watching. There's so much stuff that you can watch these days. And another thing is hunting in realistic shooting form. I mean, we're all rock stars in our backyard, standing there, you know, perfectly. Exactly. The feet are level on the ground, everything like that. But, you know, how often is that going to happen, right?
Never. So, almost never. Almost never. Especially elk hunting. I feel like most of my shots have always been taken from either kneeling or sitting position. When I set up, I'm not standing in front of something. I'm kneeling in front of whatever cover it is that I'm, I'm not
breaking up your,
I'm not trying to stand up and give myself away. I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. you can get in situations where you back yourself into like a group of bushes, trees, whatever. I don't know.
But see, but there in Arizona, you got like the same country we do here in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it seems like all the pines, the branches don't start till a certain height.
Yeah,
up,
exactly.
Right?
I have to get down to see. Like, you see under everything. You know?
But you take that same thing and you take it to Oregon. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no way in that lush Oregon side that I'm going to get on my knees or I ain't going to see crap, right? It's just, it's different for the vegetation. So, you know, I it's dependent, and I always have to be careful because I see things from a perspective that's regional, really, sometimes, you know, so, but you're absolutely right. You got to practice from all that. I think, you know, I've taken 36 elk on public land, and I've shot two standing. The rest of them have been from a down position, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've even done a one knee draw on a couple of them where you just had to get down all of a sudden to get that view. You know, so there's different things that you have to practice for. You know, even you need to practice drawing and moving four steps to your right and then shooting.
Yep,
you know,
absolutely.
Draw, move four steps to your left and shoot. Draw, move four steps to your right, grunt, shoot. You know, practice those types of things. Practice being on your knees and knowing that, okay, now I have to rotate my knees to the left. I have to twist to the left and now take that shot, right? So just I think people get the point. I might be beating a dead horse.
No, but it's important enough that it kind of needs to get beaten in there a little bit. You know, I was talking about confidence earlier. Like, my main focus right now, a month out, is is my practice with the bow. And my calls too as well. And it's not the time to learn something new. Okay. The time to learn something new, that's past. That's gone. You don't want to try to do something that you haven't done before, that you haven't had a lot of experience before, 30 days out before your hunt. That's in my opinion. But I don't know how fast a learner you are, but like for me right now, I mean, I got video after video of this stuff out on YouTube and even on Instagram and stuff like that, where it was just like you were saying, you know, I'm imagining an elk walking through the trees. I'm tracking him. Mm-hmm. And then when he gets to my opening, I'll make a stop sound, or sometimes I don't make a stop sound, but, and I take my shot. And it's right. Practicing that because, and from both sides, you know, track from left to right, from right to left, because that's what you're going to be faced with. Put yourself in as many lifelike scenarios as you possibly can.
And I have another one for you, man. I mean, go pull your four arrows, your three arrows, your five arrows, whatever they are, from the target. Start walking away from your target and start throwing them out. Different directions, different distances. Just start throwing them, tossing them. And then go to it. And the first one, you have to shoot from your knees. The next one, you get to shoot standing up.
Awesome.
And also, you don't get a range finder. So you have to judge distance, because I really think a huge failure point a lot of times is, and it's great, man, if you get into a setup and you're calling them in, or you have a partner calling back behind you, you can pull the rangefinder up, you can range all the trees all around. That's awesome. But I can't tell you how many times you end up in a no crap moment where all of a sudden you see a tip of a horn, you drop down and you're getting ready to shoot. And now instead of getting into your shot process, it's like, oh, I got a range. And then by your range, this animal's moving. Mm. So now you're trying to get the rest of this stuff done without him seeing you. So, I mean, it's just like, I think we become so dependent on that range finder that you really have to work on your judging of distances. You should absolutely, I mean, 30 yards in should be a gimme, right? I don't, where you don't need a range finder. And that just comes from practice. And that's why, you know, toss shots is what I call them. Just going out there and just throw them in different directions. So you have different angles and you have to shoot them from different positions at different places. Again, doing things to raise your confidence up. Now you go and you zero in and you're 2 inches high or you're 2 inches low, right? Well, if you're taking that elk mid body where I told you to take it and it's 3 inches back, you're good. You're good as gold right there, right? So, but you have to, you're not going to kill it if you don't take the shot. You don't want to take a marginal shot. So if you want to be effective at that, you got to practice these types of things. You have to, or you are setting yourself again up for a failure point, right?
Right. Exactly. Well, I wanted to say this, but I didn't want to interrupt what you were saying. The second you sit down or kneel or stand, whatever the case is, and you're setting up to start calling to an elk.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Before you start calling, you take out your rangefinder and you get as many markers as that you can remember. Don't overdo it, because then you're going to get, you know, look at all the major shooting lanes and say, okay, this is 25 yards, this is 30 yards, this is 40 yards, this is 50 yards, whatever the case may be. Put that thing away. And just as you're calling and looking for him to come, or your buddy's calling for you, you just keep going from marker to marker. Oh, that was 45. This was 35. And you keep saying that into your head. And then when that elk shows up to present you a shot, you know within a couple of yards where he's standing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is like,
well, I'll take that to another aspect. And that's, I'm not able to tell you how many times people will stop to call. And they don't consider where they're stopping to call from.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden they see a critter coming in. They see a horn or starting to show itself up and they didn't expect it. Again, another oh crap moment. And they're someplace where they actually stopped in the limbs or they stopped behind a tree. They didn't consider shooting lanes and the ability to shoot and what's around them so that they could draw before they even stopped to call.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Right.
Yep.
You almost, I tell people, when you're moving through the woods and you're going to stop to call, you know, don't be standing in the sun. Don't be putting yourself in a position where you can't get your bow and draw and or where you don't have a backdrop. You know, you need to consider the fact that you're calling to an animal all this time. Well, it's likely he's going to show up, right?
Right.
It's kind of like it's like fishing and not having your pole down in a position where you could set the hook. It's like just, you know, it's all loose and it's just, you know, you have an opportunity and you miss it. Oh, almost had one. Ah, almost had one. So, that's something to consider. And it's funny when we were talking about the shots, John, I don't know about you, but I see a lot of these photographs of people at Mountain Archery Fest and TAC and different things like that are on steep slopes. Mm-hmm. And you can see them shooting down a hill with that bow arm dropped all the way down.
All the time. I just did hike the hunt challenge. Mm-hmm. Was it last weekend? Yeah, I think it was last weekend. And, you know, I was shooting with a group of guys that I didn't know. And I was like, man, I just need to shut up. I don't want to keep talking to people and like, you know, cause they don't, you know, it's not like solicited advice. They're not asking me for advice, you know, and I'm just giving advice. But that was one of the things that came out. I was like, I'm like, you do want to know why you missed that? He's like, yeah. I'm like, well, you're shooting extremely sharp angle downhill. And what you need to do, and now for hunting purposes, this is, I have mixed reviews about this because you might be giving yourself away a little bit by making more motion, but you draw outwards, like perpendicular to, or, you know, like so that you would be in a perfect T, whether you're sitting, kneeling, standing, whatever.
Absolutely. You get in your T.
And then bend at the waist.
Yep. Yeah. And look, you have to because nobody, when you put your bow and push it at them, mm-hmm. unless you're really good at bending your waist first right away.
Right.
It's most people are going to put the arm down and they're going to draw back and they're going to be already in an awkward position if they do that. You're absolutely right. You need to create the tee.
Yeah.
And then you need to go down or you need to go up with it just to ensure that you're in that form, man, instead of, you know, changing that and then, you know, shooting over, way over or way under according to, you know, whichever it is, right?
Right. Well, to be honest with you, you just said something that sparked another thing in the memory of this past weekend. And I don't want to pick on these guys. One of the guys that I was shooting with is very novice. Just picked up bow hunting very recently. So, and he was the only guy that wasn't doing it. Everybody else was sky drawing. And I don't know if you don't know what that is, you point your bow up in the sky and you draw back and then you come down.
Right.
And that to me, especially for hunting, is a giant no-no. It's like, hey, I'm over here waving at the animal. So like be conscious of that. Like try to have as little bit of minimum. This is not a 30-day out thing, but this is just in the moment thing to think about, you know.
Yeah, and it's
practice that way, you know.
Yeah, it's actually a strengthening thing too, because really, I mean, I've just gone through a lot of shoulder rehab because what happens is, and where a lot of people get that from is, and it happened to me, I had a shoulder injury about 4 years ago, and without noticing it, I used to shoot so much. When I shot instinctive with my bow, I mean, I was shooting 100, 120 arrows in a session, right? Hmm. And shooting so much that, and with the shoulder injury, that what you do is you end up shifting down and you start bicepping, you know, really like a bicep pull. Mm. Of your string rather than, you know, up and drawing back using that shoulder in an up position, because you're protecting, you're actually recruiting other muscles. But then when you do that, you end up with a low elbow, and now you got to rotate that elbow up while it's loaded, and it continues to actually create more damage to the shoulders. And it's a hard habit not to do, because especially if you're strong and you're big, you get away with it and you don't even notice it, right? Mm-hmm. Until some years later when something starts happening to the – so it's really that – what you're talking about there is absolutely, man, it's a strengthening thing. It's a maybe dialing the bow down type thing, because everybody thinks that they have to shoot 70 or 80 and you don't.
100 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, I totally agree with you on that, man, that the less movement that you can do, and you can actually, a lot of these guys that are good at that shoulder don't have to raise it way up to do that bicep pull. I mean, you can almost just do that straight out as well, mm-hmm. but you're still having to rotate that into that shoulder on load, which isn't good for it. And I'm a prime example of that.
Me too. So, I do. Yeah. I know I don't. I come across my chest mm-hmm. low and then I anchor back. But that's, I mean, I've done that my whole life. Like, that's kind of like my,
yep.
my process, and I haven't changed it because I don't know. I just, it works.
So
it works
to.
For me.
I, yeah,
but the sky draw thing, like that to me is just like a thing.
Yeah. I just went through 5 months of therapy, man, to get over that. So yeah, things have changed a little bit. But so moving on to some of those other areas, you know, I mentioned the physical prep 30 days out.
Right.
And what I find though is a lot of guys get in panic mode right now. And you know, if you've been working out, you're doing workouts, and one of the guys I coach is just a great individual, man, Scott Carr. Him and his buddy, Mike Anderson, I think they just won, it's one of those big, events where, you know, you're packing shooting and stuff like that. These guys are just beasts. Yeah. They're just animals. They're really, really, and great guys. And, you know, when I'm talking to the guys I'm coaching, I'm basically is like, look, right now you're 30 days out, you're in maintenance mode. Right. So don't be like adding anything different to your workout. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the main reason I tell that is because a lot of people will start now to try to overdo it. So they start throwing tons of weight on, and then they try to like go up these hills with tons of weight and end up tweaking something, you know, 2 weeks out from the hunt that's going to hamper them. So,
right.
Unless you're doing already those types of workouts, you're good. You're great. You're good to go. And if you did only start there in the beginning of July, you know, 4 weeks out in August isn't the time to increase that. I mean, sure, put a pack on while you're going, just like you are when you're going to hunt with. That's not a big increase, but just going crazy with weights and doing something that could injure yourself is not a good idea at this point, right?
Right, right. And of course, this is all depending on how you're working out, but me leading up to, I don't know, probably June, I'm very well-rounded. Actually, shouldn't even say that. I kind of start off more strength stuff earlier on, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. then I get more well-rounded, meaning I do start adding in more cardio, more of that type of movement. And then it starts to switch from once I've gotten to a certain strength level, I typically will switch more to repetition type stuff, but not to the point where I'm causing overuse injury. I'm just
right.
going more like 20 rep type lifting. And then, you know, right about now, I'm going to start changing to like a HIIT style, something that's just keeping my heart rate up. Yeah. Keeping the heart rate up. Really focusing on the cardio, but still hitting some of the strength stuff, because you're not going to lose at this point, you know, and if you do, it's going to be very minimal.
Yeah, absolutely. Done. And the thing is too, is man, I mean, when you're doing the strength stuff, I mean, we're talking about, sure, prepare for success, but I guarantee you, man, you know, where you're at right now, you're not going to change it a whole lot, you know, at this point in time in strengthening. You know, maybe back in May, starting then, you might have changed the strength. But right now, you're not going to change it that much. And really, the areas that you got to prepare for is if you're going to swim the English Channel, you better be swimming. If
I would say sport-specific training. Yep.
Absolutely.
You take the words out of my mouth.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you live in a place, and I have people that tell me all the time, they go, well, I don't have any hills to practice on. Shoot, man. If you don't have any hills, most likely you're living in cities where they have big hotels, they got big buildings, hit the steps on those.
Find
Find those overpasses that have those big hills and go up and down on those, on the side of those. I mean, you know, prepare yourself for what you are actually going to be doing. And, you know, the fact that you're going to be stepping over things and over things and over things and going up and down on hills with weight on your back, that's what you need to be doing. And what you were talking about with the HIIT, John, and what people, if they don't understand that, you know, that is high intensity training. So, for example, you know, when you're chasing an elk and all of a sudden that elk is just over the top of the ridge and you got to get up to the top of that ridge, get in position, be ready to shoot and do it while you can actually be breathing and your eyes aren't all unfocused and everything. So, you know, hitting something for that 10, 15, 20 seconds hard and then, you know, giving yourself just very little bit of breathing and doing that maybe three times. So you go like 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off, 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off, something like that, so that it's high intensity, really making you breathe hard, that's preparing you for those moments like that. Because it's not the fact that you're not able to get there to see that animal. It's now that you get there to see that animal, and can you breathe well enough to keep your pin on that animal, right? So that's and again, you're showing your experience, John.
Yeah, I learned this long time ago. Matter of fact, I think on YouTube, there's from like 11 years ago, there's a video of me and I'm running, doing sprints, then stopping, picking up my bow and shooting.
And shooting. Yeah.
So it's me training myself to get my heart rate up, to get in that huff and puff situation and be able to gather myself enough to make a shot. And that's huge.
You know what's
training.
Funny is when I shoot multiple arrows in a row, I've noticed I'm like out of breath after I do it. And I'm like, why am I out of breath? And it's because I've trained myself years ago to, when I'm getting ready to shoot, I breathe in, hold my breath.
Yep.
You know, and then take that shot. I might, you know, exhale a little bit slowly, but most of the time I'm just holding my breath and just so that I'm not having up and down type stuff. And so you do that multiple arrows and it's like, oh man, why am I like, you know, it's because you have to practice those types of things. You can't just sit there and you've got to get there, take it, pop, you know, so you have to practice those things, exactly what you're talking about. And it raises, everything falls in line with preparation to confidence, right?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
Yep, exactly. Because that's what you're trying to do. You never want to be surprised about what it is that you're doing, like, especially when it comes to shooting. Like, you don't want to shoot something and be like, oh my God, I actually hit it. You know, you want to know whether it's the truth or not. You want to think, so I'm going to let this arrow go. This, you're mine. You're done. This is it. You know?
Yep. So. Absolutely, man. And so that, let's talk about confidence too. I mean, we've talked about a lot of this stuff. Well, there's other ways that they need to prepare. Like a lot of people have done the logistics for getting to there, and they might have an e-scouting game plan. Hopefully, if they're fortunate, but I can't tell you how many thousands of people are going to be hunting out that never were able to get boots on the ground when they got there. So
that's
they
me.
Actually, what's that?
That's me. Unless I draw a tag here in Arizona, which is a different story. But I can't think of a single elk hunt that I've been in out of state that I've had a chance to go and physically scout.
So let me ask you a question then, man. I mean, because, you know, you're like me. You have e-scouting down, right? You're able to look at it. You do all these different things. But all of these hunts that you've gone on, when have you ever gone someplace after e-scouting where it wasn't like, oh my God, that's what it looks like, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's probably been a long time since I've been surprised because I've done it so much for so long. Like when I had the TV show and stuff, that's all. I live my seasons a week at a time. Like there's no, because I'm a generalist, I'm not just an elk hunter, I'm not just a deer hunter or whatever. I go everywhere and just, I mean, in the, just to give you an idea, the end of August, the beginning and all of September. I'm going to be in New Mexico hunting antelope. Then I come home and I'm going elk hunting in Colorado, come home, going moose hunting in Montana, come home.
Wow.
it's like, I don't have, you know, I can't tell my wife, hey, you know, I'm gone, you know, 80, 90 days a year and be like, hey, listen, I need another 20 days of scouting. Like,
I
won't have a wife and kids, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So unless it's something where I can parlay it, where I'm taking the kids camping or whatever.
Right.
I'm not scouting. So I've gotten really good, even before we had the technology that we have in the art of intel gathering, you know, and trying to figure out what and how to do it. And then once I'm there, I've really came up with I don't really know how to quantify it, I guess, or put it in words, how I look at the terrain, I look at the sign, and I'm able to figure it out. And I figure it out pretty quickly, you know, within the first 2 days that I'm there, so that I know that I have five solid days of hunting.
But that's because you see things differently as well. I mean, and that's one of the things that I try to teach people in my course that I do and try to teach people is it's a different type of awareness. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like a guy that walks up to a lake and you can look at it and you can tell where you're going to catch a fish. Right.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's that innate ability. Well, it's not innate either. I mean, it's after years of experience. I mean, the same thing when people talk about go with your gut, it's hard to go with your gut if you don't have experience to go off with that. Your gut could tell you wrong things, but you know, after so many years, you actually, that's why you've developed that ability to be able to evaluate and verify so quick. You can go into an area, you know what areas to travel to be able to, that you should see sign, that you should see track. If there's animals in this area, they should definitely be going here, here, or here, because this is the type of area that's going to attract them. If it's not there, if I evaluate it and verified that is there are either there or not there, I'm moving on, right? And you're able to do that quickly.
Yeah.
And I think that's a problem. And that's one of the things that I wanted to point out is that 30 days out, you need to have your game plan for when you get there. I mean, you need to have that pre-day one game plan. Like, let's say you get there in the morning of and you set up a camp or whatever you're going to be doing if you're packing in, but you need to have that pre-day one plan so that you can kind of verify what, first of all, your plan A is, right? Mm-hmm. Because you, on a 5-day hunt, you only spend 3 days trying to verify that your plan A was a dud.
Right.
So
Right.
You should be able to, you know, verify that area immediately by going to certain things because you had that pre-day one evening. All right. Now, let's say you don't. Let's say you get in and you get at night and you're going to have to go day one. Well, now you have to change that evaluation and verify as part of your hunt plan. And it's kind of almost like a scout hunting trip to verify that, which there's nothing wrong with. A lot of people got to do, but you got to be able to do it in a way that, again, you can verify or evaluate that area quickly and understand that. And at the same time, doing it in the places, because that's where the elk should be, that give you an opportunity, you know, for an encounter on that day as well. And I tell people, I really think a lot of times you probably, and this happens to me a ton when I'm scouting, there's so many times you end up with an encounter when you are scouting because you actually cover country differently than a lot of people that come out here and start hunting. They like immediately go into like slow stealth mode instead of move and find mode.
Right.
So, you got to have that. You got to have that pre-day one game plan. And then you got to have that day one game plan in place, whether or not on that pre-day one, you know, you're trying to locate, either you're going out and verifying, you're finding the fresh track, you're going to those places that are going to show, whether it's around a wallow or a water area, or it's certain road crossings, or it's paths of least resistance through saddles or funnels or choke points where you're checking. And then maybe that night doing some night bugling to make sure that you have something that you can jump on to make your next day, your first day out there as efficient as possible, because you know your first day is going to be your best day. You're in your best physical shape, you're in your best mental shape, all of that is happening out there on that day one. So, you know, make that as efficient as possible with that plan that you're going to have. And, you know, like I was just mentioning to John, you have tons of experience. You know, you've been out west and you've hunted so many areas. I mean, listen, where people, if they listen to the hunts that you're doing right now, you know, you are not shocked anymore, but I'm telling you, people that have been e-scouting only, they have to really prepare themselves mentally for the reality once they get there.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if it's their first trip, man.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, again, you said the experience. So trust me when I say that, I mean, I still get surprised to an extent, you know. But it's the course of over the year. Actually, you know what? I'm going to back up. One of the things that, cause I don't want to throw information out to people that they're not going to be able to apply right now. One of the things that helped me out more so than anything, because the one thing that you can get from the technology is 100% is you can get the topography.
Right.
You can get where water's at. You can get access points. You can see road systems. Generally, you can see where agriculture is. You can see where private and public lands meet. So those are that's the information you know you can get. You can't necessarily discern, am I looking at feed or is this cover? Or am I looking at, you know, is this rocky stuff that's underneath this trees or is it, you know, grass? You know, you don't know what you're looking at,
right?
Like that. So
yeah.
One thing that helped me out the most was reading topography and understanding how animals use it. And I say animals because they almost all use it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I actually wrote an article called Mapping Trophy Bucks. I think it's on my blog. I wrote it for a couple different I wrote it for a magazine and it got re-released twice. I think Bowhunter Magazine and then maybe, when I was writing for E-Hunter. But, I want to say it's on my blog now. Mapping Trophy Bucks, and I'm talking about hunting whitetail, but I talk about saddles. I talk about benches. I talk about intersecting ridge lines. I talk about drainages and all this other stuff in there. And all those things are things that you can apply to elk hunting, to deer hunting, to anything.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And those are the things that you can look at a topo map. You can look at Google Earth and you can discern those things. And it's going to give you a leg up of where to be to find animals, or at least find animal sign. And once you're, if you're not seeing sign in those particular areas that I go over in that article, chances are there's not elk there.
Right.
Because if they're not using benches, if they're not using, you know, intersections and saddles and all this stuff, pretty much guarantee you they're not there.
Yeah. Because I mean, that's their pathway to their food and their water and their bed. I mean, it's their hallways. And if they're not using their hallways, then there's nobody at home. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's the way I like to think about that. And don't forget to reverse engineer. Go to those places that they have to be at. Go to those places that are their watering spots and their feed spots. Find those tracks and then reverse engineer. Because if you're not finding tracks where they water and where they eat, you're not finding elk. That's simple, man.
Yeah.
And, you know, very good point on that.
Yeah. I mean, if you just said something that, you know, if you're hunting here in the Southwest, they need water. I mean, they need water everywhere, but they really need water here. So
it's
the easiest thing for you to find elk animals in general when you're hunting in New Mexico and Arizona and, you know, some of Nevada and whatnot, because they have to be where the water's at. So start at a water and reverse engineer, like you said. Yep. Think about things that way. That's another thing that's always been my thing. So what do animals need, right? What do they need, and what does this area that I'm looking at provide for their needs? And just going to those spots and reverse engineering them, looking at it, you know, looking at it through that scope versus.
Well, that's like everybody that's saying, you know, okay, so bulls need to breed at this time of year, right? They need to breed. That's what's on their mind.
Right.
But who are they breeding with, right?
Yeah.
And the cows need to eat. And so the cows are going to be where the best feed are.
Mm.
And the bulls are going to go where the cows are. It's, you know, build it and they will come. So, you know, I tell people, man, if I had to think about what my strategy is really based on cows. It's not based on bulls. You know, I know how bulls behave because of the cows, and I play on that as their weakness. Because that's what it is. Just like us as men, we have our weakness because of the women that are out there. I mean, it's just, you know, we make dumb decisions or a lot of different decisions based on that. So,
I'd be a really rich man if I wasn't in love with my wife.
In a different way.
Exactly.
Yeah. Life is rich right now, dude. I see all your family stuff and the things you do, and I'm just, I tell you, I'm proud to know you, John, man. You're a good dad. You're a good husband.
Make me blush.
And you're passionate about what you do. And everything. So, no, you're a very rich man, buddy. Trust me.
I know.
I appreciate that about you.
I know it. Every time I find myself starting to complain about my life, I stop myself and was like, shut the hell up, bro. You got everything.
So. Oh yeah, you're killing it. You really are. You're doing great, man. And the one thing I probably left out last, and is probably the one thing that most people are most worried about at this time, is their calls and their calling strategies, right?
Yeah.
And really though, you know, I think it's great that what we just talked about as far as the game plan and finding elk and reverse engineering, because there's so many people that are going to go into an area and they're going to run a ridge and they're going to use a bugle response strategy. They're going to basically be hunting bugles, that they're going to leave elk and continue trying to find elk even though they're there, right? Just because that's the only tool in their toolbox. So, you know, when you were talking about earlier about, you know, it's not the time to learn new things, but it is a time still, especially when it comes to calls and calling strategies, to soak up as much as you can so that you do have that gut instinct, you do have that ability to try alternate strategies, and you have ideas and suggestions of what they are, you know. So like your calls, man, I mean, if all you can do is just a basic cow call, now, you know, learn how to put some enthusiasm into those, how to put some emotion into those by listening to different things that are doing that, and really still trying to learn even up to the day that you're going over that what some things mean. Just so it's kind of like, you know, if you're going to go meet a group of people for the first time to speak a foreign language, you know, you're just not going to go up and show up. You're going to continue as you're going to be able to learn how to say hello, or, right, you know, trying to tell them I'm hungry, or, you know, get away from me, you know, those types of things. So, I mean, keep learning, and your calls and calling strategy is something that you're going to continue to learn out in the field, man. There's actual practical application there. You get to try things, get crazy. Don't get scared to not call because you're worried that you're going to mess something up. I think people that go silent on their hunt are really the people losing out, because you really have sometimes opportunities to do some things with animals that are within your vicinity that you will never know even exist if you don't call to them. And that doesn't mean they're always going to answer you, but there's different ways to get them to come into you. So, their response isn't always this bugle verbally. Sometimes it's a mew that's coming back. Sometimes it's raking. Sometimes it's that animal coming in silently, man. So, keep filling that toolbox. I mean, keep filling it as much and as often as you can, and develop those different calling strategies. What are you going to do? What are you going to start out with? Are you just going to scream ridges? Are you looking just for that single bull to respond? Well, all I can tell you is that 95% of the people that are going to be out there hunting this year are going to be using that strategy. And yet we have a 95% failure rate really on most elk hunters, other than 10% of the people that are rocking it every year doing the same thing and killing elk constantly, mm-hmm, because they have variances in their game and their calling strategies and they're able to adapt. So that's one thing I want to tell you, man, is fill up that daggum, you know, toolbox of calling strategies as much as you can. You know, I'm very cow oriented myself. I'm always a lover before I'm a fighter, mm-hmm, but I can fight with the best of them, you know? Yep. So, it's just, you know, I know it's awesome to get a bull screaming, but I mean, you go out there and you cow call and a bull answers to a cow call. Don't go scream at that bull right away. You know, that's not the thing to do. That's not what that bull answered to. That bull answered to a call, to a cow, and there's a reason he did. And that doesn't mean you have to inject a bull into the equation right away. So, you know, it's just, in these 30 days out, you know, because I coach guys that are working on their calling, and I can tell you that a lot of people are way too much tongue pressure on calls, really trying to force squeak things out.
Uh-huh.
They want to practice their bugles more than anything. And it's kind of like kids that I coach in basketball. They just want to shoot 3-point shots all the time when that's only a 30% shot, and you're going to score a lot more with moves going to the basket. So,
right,
you know, work those other strategies, I think, is the best thing that I want to tell them out there.
Awesome. Well, I think we've given everybody some food for thought here, and some things to think about leading up to their hunts and things to do. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your knowledge with us. It's always a pleasure having you on.
It's always good to be on with you, John, man.
Awesome. Go check out what Joe's got going on with Elk Bros and take a listen to his podcast.
We have our base camp online hunting course. If you want to fill up any of that toolbox, go check it out. It's never too late to learn. Knowledge is power. So you can find that at elkbros.com. Our podcast is the Elk Bros Blue Collar Elk Hunting. Just do a search for elk hunting. We'll pop up. I'd also like to encourage everybody here to support your local, state, and national programs that are helping to advocate for us. I know John doesn't do it on his podcast here because that's not the intention, but if you haven't taken a look at HOWL, and that's H-O-W-L .org, if you haven't taken a look at that, you need to. It's important that, you know, we support those people, those places, those organizations that are our best advocates for us as hunters and pulling us together and helping us to have a voice. So I'm just going to give that a plug, John, out
there.
Thank
you. Appreciate it.
Absolutely, man.
Thanks a lot. And thanks for coming on. We'll talk to you soon. Hopefully you have a great season and we'll have some good stories to share afterwards.
Well, I tell you what, man. If you can't be handsome, you can at least be handy, man. I'll try to be handy while I'm out there.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Have a good one.
Thanks, man.
Bye.
All right.